Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Karen Cam Radio Show. The intention of this show is to empower and inspire you to manifest the life of your dreams, whether it's radiant health, prosperity, loving relationships, or simply peace of mind. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Cam, author of the number one bestseller, Guide to Healing Chronic Pain, A Holistic Approach. If you don't have a copy of my book, you can get the first six chapters free on my website, which is working this week, yay, www.karencan.com. And when you put your name and email address to get into my mailing list, you'll actually get a link where you can download the excerpt of the book and five of my Fast Track Your Healing webinar classes absolutely free. So please join me. Also on Facebook, I'm on Facebook a lot. You'll see me posting, recipes this week on bars and bone broth and gummy bears and the things I'm into. And today's show is really special because, we've had Dr. Kelly Brogan on our show before. I absolutely loved talking to this woman. And it's so cool to I get to an MD colleague who kind of gets what the kind of stuff that I'm into and who's into natural holistic health. And, I mean, she's not even that far away. You know, she's in the state of New York. And when her book, A Mind of Your Own, came out, I was so excited because I knew that this was something we really needed. Now, just a little story, which I normally do at the beginning of the show, I want to tell you that, you know, I grew up with a mom who was depressed. And it was really, really difficult. Every night she would come back home and complain and about, you know, her work and the whole bit. And she's very sensitive and empathic, and I understand why, you know, this was happening. But at the time, it was really hard as a kid growing up, and so she'd been on antidepressant after antidepressant, and she would stop them, and she would go into this horrible, I don't know what it was, but it just sounded like, you know, she just fell apart. And then we'd, you know, put her back on the antidepressants, and it wasn't, about 10 years ago, actually, almost 10 years ago, where when I was discovering the LifeWave patches, the energy enhancer, she had a rash and some sort of weird thing on her skin, like a bunch of hives. So I said, Mom, you know, put this on your liver 3 acupuncture point. That should help clear the heat and should help you detoxify and take probiotics. And that's about as simple as I could get with her because she wasn't really open to a lot of other things. So she did that, and the symptoms got better, and fascinatingly, her depression got better. And then she wanted to get off her medications, and I was the one that said, Mom, don't do it without a doctor supervision, because you just went crazy the last couple of times. And she did. She weaned off slowly, and she did really well. And I was like, hey, this is really awesome. But, you know, just not that long ago, I have one of my kids. I call them affectionately my kids, but they're not my kids. They're other people's kids because I don't have kids. And I heard that this person was going on antidepressants. And I got to tell you, my heart sank because I knew that, you know, diet, mental, emotional boundaries, you know, there's all these different spiritual things. There's all these different things that could have been done. But I really believe that she was being pushed by people around her to say, hey, get fixed. I mean, not in a mean way, but in a loving way, because they don't know any other option. So thank goodness, you know, this book came out, A Mind of Your Own by Dr. Kelly Brogan. And I got to tell you, I can totally see why the media blacklisted this book, because in the very first early pages, it's pretty obvious what Dr. Kelly thinks about the pharmaceutical industry. So welcome, Dr. Kelly, to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. What an introduction. Wow. It's great to be here with such a like mind.
Oh, yeah. This is so great. So, and we have, we have a lot to cover. And one of the first things I want to ask you is, first of all, tell us about your story, because I know that you've gone through some medical issues just like I have. And sometimes that spurs us on to, like, help heal others.
No question. In fact, you know, I've begun to understand that it's really the only way to learn, right? We don't learn through sharing facts and information, certainly not as readily and as powerfully as we do through our own experience. So, you know, I was, I'm a totally conventionally trained psychiatrist, absolutely believed for much of my life that, you know, perfect health was just one prescription away at any given time, right? And I did a fellowship where I further specialized in medicating, essentially, pregnant and postpartum women, breastfeeding women. And so I remember that I was writing a prescription for a patient for Zoloft, and she was pregnant, and I was pregnant myself. And I remember having this, like, little voice inside come up and you know, essentially say, well, I wouldn't want to take this as a pregnant woman, right? And I sort of ignored it and went on with my business, you know, what I had been trained to do. And it wasn't until about 9 months postpartum when I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's thyroiditis, the first medical problem I'd ever had, that same voice came up and said, I don't want to take a prescription for the rest of my life now. This sucks, right? So I sort of was like, from that space that I decided very uncharacteristically to consult with a naturopath, because I knew that conventional medicine only had Synthroid to offer me in ever-escalating doses for the rest of my life. And I just had the intuitive hit that there was some other perspective on this that might give me, you know, sort of a get-out-of-jail-free card. And so it was from there that I began to learn all of these things I had never been exposed to during my conventional training, things like, you know, diet matters, and you can put chronic disease into remission through lifestyle change. And, you know, there's actually an evidence base for a ton of the natural medicine available to us, whether it's herbs or fatty acids or amino acids. And I began to sort of like have some red flags raised, because I had been told a very different story about human health through my conventional, even Ivy League training. And I began to say, you know, there's more to the story here. And I did my own research. And, you know, now almost a decade later, I feel fairly certain that much of what I learned in my conventional training was unduly influenced by industry and really by a consciousness that is beginning to exhibit its own bankruptcy, right? Which is the consciousness that says, well, we can command the body into submission, and we just need to make it cooperate, and nature is something to be controlled, and, you know, we're really close to, you know, getting it where it belongs in its position of submission, you know. So there's a lot about the way we've all been thinking about life on this planet that is beginning to shift, and I think we all sort of feel that. So it's a pretty exciting time, actually, when you can move through, you know, sort of how difficult it is to let go of so many of these long-held assumptions.
Oh, that is so true. And I was reading a different book, a spiritual book by Anna Deus Judith, and she talks about the masculine and the feminine energies, and, you know, we're fluxing from the masculine back into the feminine, and then we're going to have this balance and integration. So instead of pummeling nature to death because we want to control it, including our bodies, we can work with our natural rhythms. And at the same time, it doesn't mean going back into the dark ages. You're not talking about going back into the dark ages, not having a fridge, not having, you know, a stove or anything like that, but to work with technology, work with what we know, the knowledge we have. And I really liked that your book is evidence-based too. Now, in saying that, there's a part where I read that the, you know, in the Lancet, how they you know, there's a big wig in the Lancet said that a lot of the studies are really skewed and maybe 50% aren't even accurate. So, like, where does that leave us? Just personal experience as far as what's working, what's not?
I love this question. Such a good question, because every time, you know, I reference the evidence and I talk about how many studies I invoked in the writing of this book and how many tens of thousands, literally, of hours I have put into, you know, PubMed.gov over the past decade, at the same time, I realize that this is just a rhetorical tool, you know, that science is really only meant to help us reflect and support and engender further understanding of nature. You know, when it's doing anything else, including helping us to, you know, encouraging us to sort of like commandeer it, it's dangerous, actually. And so much of the literature that has been published in the service of a pharmaceutical model of health has been done, you know, has been published because of so many of the manipulative tactics that are really, you know, allowed and permitted on the part of the FDA and other, you know, sort of authorities, you know, permitted on the part of the pharmaceutical industry. So at the same time as I sort of, you know, uphold so much of what I do as evidence-based, I also understand that the way we are accruing evidence is changing. And so the relevance of the randomized trial is sort of dwindling into nothingness. So I prefer, you know, to think about things as, you know, what is called N of one medicine, right? So statistics are only so interesting. You know, when you are really regarded as your own entity, as your own sort of very unique representation of so many forces and factors that came, you know, together to create you and your experience, that is how you can begin to understand to be your own doctor, right? Which is my goal for every human, is really to reclaim autonomy in their health and to be reminded that they are their best, they and their intuition are their best guide. So really the randomized trial has nothing to do with that kind of medicine. And I think, you know, we're beginning to understand that science has to begin to sort of like shed some of the dogma around what we are even calling real evidence.
Exactly. And, yeah, you know, movies like What the Bleep Do We Know, and about kind of making quantum physics come into our living rooms in a way
yes.
we can understand, you know, tells us, hey, you know, the observer has a lot to do with what happens in
exactly.
the outcome. And so how much, you know, it's the whole, we love the left brain so much, we're going to totally ignore the right brain intuitive stuff, and people aren't, you know, we're sick of that. And the ones that are conscious of that really get the shift that's going on, but the ones that are not conscious, sometimes they're just immediately becoming empathic and don't even know why. They don't want to do something, and conflicts are coming up because their boundaries are being, you know, messed with, and now they're finally saying, hey, this doesn't feel good, so this is really great. And you're just saying exactly what I've been feeling, you know, in my life and, you know, personal life, and as well as in the office. And what? So if somebody were to, okay, say, so I'm going to give you this example. So somebody is supposedly having these feelings of, you know, depression or anxiety, and they are being told they need to go on medication by their doctor or by their mother or by their husband or whatever. How would you counsel them? What would you be your approach?
So, you know, I should preface this by saying that my mission is to make sure that everyone who is confronting, you know, treatment decisions around their struggle, to make sure that they are exposed to the fullest picture of the truth possible, right? Mm-hmm. And from there, I really believe that everyone is entitled to their own journey, right? It is absolutely not my place to tell anyone what to do, including my very own patients. And it certainly isn't my goal to, you know, to take options away from patients who feel that medication is the best choice for them. But I want to make sure that they're making that decision in the fullest of informed consent. And my grave concern is that that is not what's going on in doctors' offices across this country today. And I know that because I participated personally as a prescribing psychiatrist, you know, in the incomplete disclosure, because I didn't know, you know, what the fuller story was in terms of what the evidence is showing us in terms of safety and efficacy of antidepressants. So, you know, what I would say is that we've really been told a story about depression, and we've been told that it's something that you are probably born with, right? It manifests at some point in your life as a chemical imbalance that requires chemicals, right? So it requires medications to manage it for the rest of your mm-hmm. life, just in the same way as a diabetic would require insulin, you know, to be stable throughout their life. And, you know, what I have really unearthed when I began to scratch beneath the surface of the data that I was exposed to in my training, because I've always been very interested in, you know, what researchers are concluding and how they're concluding it, even when I was prescribing. I've always had my nose in PubMed. You know, when I began to look at non-industry funded data and science, and I began to listen to experts and, you know, clinicians who had nothing to gain by speaking out about what they had learned, I began to understand that this story is actually a myth. Right. So, in fact, there is no valid science to support the notion of a chemical imbalance, let alone something as specific as a serotonin deficiency. Right. And, in fact, these medications don't work in the way you've been told that they do. And their dangers and risks are so much more significant and so very unpredictable, to an extent that I actually believe, you know, the practice of prescribing these medications should be halted until we have further information. So this is a conclusion I came to really through many stages of shock and actually rage and grief, you know, because I believed exactly what so many people believe, which is that there is treatment available. How could you withhold it from someone? It absolutely is what they should be doing if they're struggling. And, you know, I really had to reckon with, you know, so many of the beliefs and assumptions I'd become very comfy cozy with over the years. And so I get it. I get the sort of intense reactions that people can have when they are exposed to this other side of the story. So, you know, maybe a more compelling way to look at it, if that is activating to you to hear, a more compelling way to look at it is that if we can at least agree that there are many roads to depression, right, that depression isn't like other kinds of medical diseases where you can, you know, get a blood test or an EEG or a brain scan or any sort of more objective, quote-unquote, objective measure for diagnosis. Depression is not that. You can be diagnosed with depression, you know, in a four-minute quiz online on WebMD, right, let alone a 10-minute office visit with your family practice doctor. Mm-hmm. It's a subjective label, right? And so if we can agree that there are many things that can masquerade as depression and anxiety, by the way, and I would put actually many psychiatric labels in this category, but let's just focus on that, then isn't it at least something to consider that you might have an opportunity to reverse it completely rather than just paper it over with medication for the rest of your life, right? Because any psychiatrist you see is going to recommend that, well, I shouldn't say any, most, is going to recommend that you take medication for the rest of your life. So what if there was, as I said, a get-out-of-jail-free card? What if there was an opportunity for you to actually reverse what is being called depression? And that's really what I go through in the book, right? Because I think it's really tragic to treat, you know, hypothyroidism, low thyroid functioning with Zoloft, right? It would be a mistake, right, you could argue, to treat blood sugar imbalance with Prozac. And it would be, you know, like really opting out of a powerful opportunity, you know, to treat, you know, food intolerance, let's say to wheat or dairy, you know, with Effexor. These things begin to make less and less sense. And when you understand that pharmaceuticals carry major burdens of side effects, then you begin to learn about the side effects of very commonly prescribed pharmaceuticals like birth control, or over-the-counter ones like Tylenol or acid blockers. And it would make even less sense to treat the side effects of those medications with a psychiatric medication, which is, as I argue so often, what is going on. So, you know, we could talk about the data undermining the safety and efficacy of these medications, or we could just talk about how, you know, it's worthwhile to at least ask the question why you might be having the symptoms you're having.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And, well, say somebody does decide for, you know, they don't want to hear it or they just not ready to make those lifestyle changes. They decide to go on an SSRI or, you know, an antidepressant for their anxiety or for their depression. In your experience, and you may not have an answer for this, but how long do they have before they can get off it without major repercussions, like a month, 5 months, 6 months, you know, like, because the withdrawal syndrome can be pretty intense for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Ago. Yeah. So there are two major categories of risks that I really feel comprise the untold story of antidepressants, and I'll touch on those. But, you know, to answer your question, I would say, you know, the literature really suggests that anything longer than 2 months, which is pretty much just beginning a medication, right, because as much as we'd like to believe that these medications are a quick fix, any prescribing psychiatrist will tell you that they take, quote-unquote, 6 to 8 weeks to work. Right. Mm-hmm. So we're not talking about a quick fix. And, you know, the program in my book and so many, you know, holistic providers like yourself can make measurable change within a month, you know, within the space of a month. So, you know, why not try something more benign before you dive into something that could take, you know, the better part of 2 months to really take any sort of effect. So that being said, everyone is very different. You know, I don't see the patients who come off these medications with ease. I never hear from them, obviously, right? I only see a skewed population of patients whose lives largely have been, you know, anything ranging from somewhat interrupted to completely debilitated by a medication taper process. So I have a skewed exposure I do think that it is always worth, if you are motivated to come off medication, it's always worth giving yourself that trial and opportunity. This is your one life, and there's no reason to believe that anyone is beyond, beyond that experience or that trial. That being said, you know, when I first started taking patients off of medication years ago, I didn't focus on lifestyle changes first. And I was running basically an outpatient rehab where, you know, I was filling out medical disability paperwork for half of my day, you know, for my patients. And it was horrendous. It really woke me up to the power of these medications in terms of their habit formation. And now, these days, I won't touch your prescription until you have committed to at least a month, if not two, often depending on, you know, what other medical issues are at play, of lifestyle change and primarily of dietary change. So that is like absolute requirement, no exceptions, and it works. And ever since instituting that, my practice has been a breeze, and I can, it's a long process. As you mentioned, you know, with your mom, it's a long process, years often, to come off of these medications, but it's a much, much more benign process than it was before we enhanced the resiliency of a patient's physiology, you know, in the setting of taper. But I I'll take just a quick opportunity to mention, one of the other sort of major concerns that I've developed around these medications when we're talking about a short amount of exposure, right? Because you might say, well, why don't I just try it to take the edge off, and then I'll figure out what I'm going to do later.
That's
right?
The attitude I hear. Yep, absolutely.
Yes, yes. And it makes sense, right? It makes total sense. Why not? Everyone is creating the illusion that these medications are safe, and they might work, and so who cares if they don't work all the time? If they work some of the time, why not just try it, and then you'll figure out how to, you know, get to the root of what's going on and all the rest of that work, right? Well, my concern is that these medications, I believe, can be some of the most dangerous chemicals on the planet. And what I began to investigate was largely based on the work of Dr. David Healy, who's a psychiatrist out of the UK, who has really devoted his career to exposing some of the unpublished and manipulated research that shows without ambiguity, in my opinion, that these medications can cause impulsivity and violence. And you know what? They can do it in a couple of doses, and we have no idea if you're going to be the victim, right? So one of the most powerful papers I've seen is from 2011, so we've known about this for a while, and it's a collection of 10 cases of completely normal citizens who went on in the space of 1 to 4 weeks after beginning psychiatric medications, but mostly SSRIs, to murder their spouses, their girlfriends, and their children. And
wow.
Some of them were sentenced, you know, to life imprisonment. And after coming off of medication shortly thereafter, you know, committing the crime, they have no recollection of doing it. It was done in a completely intoxicated state. And this paper looks at the fact that these people all had a liver variant, enzyme variant, called the cytochrome SNP. And they basically metabolized medication differently than other people, so that they were in a state of serotonin syndrome. They were in a state of essentially, you know, chemical intoxication. And that sounds like, oh, well, that must be really rare and whatever. But guess what? Nobody, not a prescriber that I'm aware of on the planet, is screening for this, you know, now known variant before prescribing these medications. So it's a veritable Russian roulette. And this is not, you know, again, something to be taken lightly, because I was trained to dismiss these kinds of concerns, and I have a lot of anger about that, because I feel it's actually, it becomes irresponsible to recommend these medications without awareness of what they're capable of.
Oh, my gosh. It's so true. I think I went through the same stages of, you know, grief and loss and being angry when I found out about some things as well. And this whole variant thing, people just don't know what they, you know, whether they have it. And you mentioned that, is there any other, aside from violence, because again, people are going to hear this and go, no, that can't be that common. I don't hear too much about it. Is there any Okay, say it, I assume that they're not going to be violent. Is there any other, like, so-called short-term risk to just trying it out to see if it helps kind of thing, that attitude?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's worth clarifying, and I could chew your ear off about this all day, but it's worth clarifying that the reason that we don't hear about it is because the media is deeply invested in keeping this connection from your awareness, right? Because if they told the truth, then you would know that every single school shooting, case of infanticide, and plane that has been brought down deliberately, you know, in the past over 10 years has been in the setting of somebody who has recently started on one of these medications or recently taken off. So the connections are all around us. It's just that we are, you know, kept behind the veil. So that's an important thing to bear in mind. But if we put that aside, which is obviously difficult to do, but if we do, in the short term, I would say the laundry list of potential side effects, whether it's, you know, bleeding risk or liver toxicity or changes to libido, you know, changes to gastrointestinal functioning, hair loss, weight gain, all these things, really pale in comparison, in my opinion, to the longer-term risk of habit formation of these medications. So as long as you're within a reasonable window, I would say, of like 6 months to a year of exposure, and you can reconsider and consider a responsible taper, it would be worth doing. Unless you're totally comfortable with the notion of staying on these medications for life, despite the fact that there isn't a single piece of evidence to suggest that you are actually going to be better off taking them for life than if you never took them at all. If you're comfortable with that, then, you know, then I would say go forth and be merry. But the question needs to be continually popping into your consciousness of like, okay, is it time now for me? Because if it is, there are ways to graduate to the next phase, and it involves undoing the reason that you were brought to medication in the first place, and it's totally possible to do that.
Oh, that's so great to hear. And I know some of the questions here, if somebody feels better, they take the medication, they feel better. So why do they feel better if it doesn't really work or if there's not a lot of evidence that it works?
Yeah, it's so interesting, right? Because every time I present the science that I've been exposed to around the inefficacy of these medications, someone gets up in the audience very indignantly and they say, well, you know, this medication saved my life. Like, I don't care what you say.
Yep, exactly.
And believe me, I've helped many patients, I thought, over the years with these medications. And it becomes a bit difficult to argue with, again, the science that shows that the reason that people believe these medications help is because they do, but they do so through what is called the active placebo effect, right? And we are taught that the placebo effect is like a bunch of, you know, nonsense, and patients are being fooled and duped, or when they're stupid or whatever, and that's why they're being tricked into these medications, thinking these medications work. Actually, it's absolutely not the case, and there's a growing awareness that so much of what we are calling efficacy, whether it's even in the realm of surgery, pain medications, and psychiatric medications, is attributable to belief, is attributable to placebo effects, and to a cascade of actual biochemical processes that are kicked off when you believe that what you are doing, that the treatment you're engaging is going to work. And it seems very relevant for psychiatry, because we are talked to ad nauseum by media and by direct-to-consumer advertising about what these medications are going to do for us to fix our chemical imbalances. And so it seems, according to the literature, very relevant that patients actually have these beliefs, because when you compare these medications to medications that have similar side effects, right, because the side effects are the ones that make you believe that you're taking a medication that's doing something, right?
Ah, true.
So when these medications are compared to medications with similar side effects, there is no difference in efficacy. And the efficacy we're talking about is really nothing more than 30, maybe 40% of the time people feel like they actually help. But even that 30 or 40%, the vast majority of it is actually, according to Irving Kirsch, who's done most of this research, is attributable to active placebo effect. So that's a really powerful concept, and it wouldn't be, again, such a big deal if they didn't carry such tremendous risks. But then there, you know, some of this, what we're calling side effects of these medications actually may be preferable for people. You know, they can be very sedating if you're having trouble sleeping. You might actually like that. That might be a chemical effect that you find helpful. And it's no different really than, you know, than drinking a couple shots of vodka before going to a party if you have social anxiety, right? But most of us know, you know, have the sense to identify that that type of chemical effect, you know, over the long term carries a lot of risks to it, right? And we wouldn't suggest that, you know, that drinking vodka for social anxiety is correcting your alcohol imbalance, right? We have a clear sense that it's a chemical effect, and it may be one that you like in the short term, but it's certainly one that's going to have a long-term cost. So it's my intention to really just reframe the way we're thinking about these medications more in those terms, and really to disabuse ourselves of the illusion that they're fixing or healing or correcting anything, because they're not. They're creating a new bodily state. And again, it may be one that you prefer and that you feel comfortable with, but it's incorrect to assume that it's actually a more optimal bodily state than the one you were dealing with before.
Right, and in Chinese medicine or Asian medicine, it's all about balance and energetic balance, and the medications do put you out of balance. And like you're saying, for some people, yeah, the side effects of this imbalance might be preferable, at least temporarily, but I don't think anybody really wants the whole, you know, the weight gain or the, you know, the numbing that a lot of people talk about, the hair loss,
yes,
definitely. We have a question here about pregnancy, and so the question is, do antidepressants or benzodiazepines prevent or somebody from being able to get pregnant? And then if someone's on birth control, what other option is there if the birth control is causing problems in their depression?
Oh, gosh. Yes. Okay. So I will give a bird's eye view of this. It's pretty clear, Karen, that I'm going to have to come back on to answer some of these questions because I actually have a patient waiting. But I will give the bird's eye view, which is that my specialization was in medicating women, right? So I medicated hundreds of women. I know the data very well that is available. My concern is that the data and the science around medication exposure and pregnancy is not asking the right questions at this point, because we're still very much, you know, in this mindset that, you know, 10 fingers and 10 toes means a healthy baby. And what we know about epigenetics, right, which is the relevance of environment to our genetic expression, has really forced us to ask different questions, like, you know, what risks would be relevant for you specifically as a woman, and what other risks are you bringing to the table in what you eat, in what you're thinking, in what you're breathing, what you're drinking, that are also factoring into the consideration of this medication exposure. So while I have seen many, you know, seemingly healthy babies born, to be honest, after psychiatric medication exposure, I am absolutely interested in championing, you know, healing the body so that a woman can ideally come off of medication before pregnancy, or during. You know, whenever it becomes available, it's like the Maya Angelou quote, it's like, when you know better, you do better. Whenever this strikes your consciousness is the right time to begin the journey. Mm-hmm. And if it happens postpartum, if it happens smack in the middle of your pregnancy, or if you're fortunate enough for it to happen before a pregnancy, then the first step is always going to be optimizing your physiology. And at least from my perspective, one of the first and easiest portals to doing that is diet. So it's really taking seriously a whole foods diet. The same goes for any other medications that you might be taking. So many of my patients come to me on Mirena IUD or NuvaRing, yeah, or birth control pills. I have become very, very frustrated and concerned about, again, the untold story psychiatrically of these synthetic hormones, and I took birth control myself for 12 years, and I can't tell you how insidious. It's so insidious. I mean, there are aspects of your personality that you have become, you know, familiar with now, thinking that they are just who you are, and they can very likely be attributed directly to synthetic hormones. I mean, so it ranges from insidious to actually, you know, clinically deeply concerning, you know, when these medications can cause, you know, the diagnosis, lead to the diagnosis of, you know, depression or anxiety or even bipolar, and it's completely related to hijacking your hormones in this way. Coming off of the of synthetic hormones is actually quite easy. For the most part, you just stop it. There's no tapering involved, at least not in my practice. But you still have to do that upfront work, right? Because if you are taking birth control for a hormonal imbalance, like PMS or PCOS or even endometriosis, which, of course, has immune involvement as well. You have to address that first before it's going to be easy for you to come off it, right? So you don't want to come off it and then all of your original symptoms that led you to it are still flaring, and you're not going to feel the level of motivation that you otherwise would feel if you healed yourself first and then came off it and then realized like you're ready to roll, you know, you're ready to roll without it. And so I'm a big advocate of, you know, of things like DAISY, which is a you know, it's essentially a basal body temperature tracking method, and beginning to learn more about what your cycle is meant to tell you about your feminine experience, right? Because, like, most of us live totally neutered of our any relationship to our hormones. And it's, you know, it sounds great, but again, it's like we've been sold a bill of goods. Like, there is no magic pill. And that's the summary, which is that there's, you know, there's this fantasy that we can just get away with a quick and easy fix to our physical problems. And it's just never what we are led to believe it is by the companies that seek to profit from, you know, upholding that belief. So, you know, it's bad news on some level, but actually the good news is that there's so much more out there. There's so much more vitality possible when you begin to work with your body as opposed to just trying to manage it. That you can't even imagine, you know, how incredible you could possibly feel until you begin to walk down this road. So that's sort of the carrot I'll leave.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, we definitely want you back on the show. I want you back on the show. and if you're willing to, that would be awesome. We can talk more about how people that, you know, if they are on antidepressants, how they can get off of it, and more about the book. And everyone can go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, their local bookstore, and order it, A Mind of Your Own by Kelly Brogan, MD. And Dr. Kelly's website is kellybroganmd.com. Lots of great information there. Get yourself on the mailing list ASAP if you're interested in the stuff. Great blog articles. I've been posting those all over the place and Facebook. So thank you, Dr. Kelly, and I can't wait till we talk to you again.
Total pleasure. This was wonderful and such an enriching conversation. And, yeah, hopefully I haven't left too many people hanging. I am doing a course companion to the book because the tapering issue is so huge for people that I want to sort of offer like even a bit of a community. Because again, you know, my goal is not to sort of like, you know, leave all this devastating information in your lap and then you're sort of like, well, what the hell do I do with this now? Because the real message is that, you know, it's totally possible to start another chapter, but first you have to have the full information, really, even to understand why you would consider, you know, taking a different path. And so it's wonderful to have a conversation with someone who so gets it. I really appreciate it, and thank you for creating a space for it.
Oh, my pleasure. And how do people get access to or sign up for to learn more about the course?
Cool. So it's called the Vital Mind Reset, and we'll be mailing about it in the next week or so. So it's going to be launching in end of May. So, but then it'll be, you know, there's nothing urgent. It'll be available forever. You know, so it's going to be there.
Oh, great. Oh, that is so fantastic. Definitely have that resource. And when we heard that you know, the media was blacklisting the book, I was like, oh, let's get on this bandwagon. Let's make sure she gets into the bestseller list. So congratulations for doing that without the help of the media.
It's an incredible, right? It's poetic because it suggests that, you know, there are new ways to get information. We don't need to rely on the man anymore to tell us what's what. And it's because of, you know, folks like you who are out there speaking the truth. So thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Dr. Kelly, and thanks everyone for listening in, for all your questions. Until next time, bye for now.